from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Gary Gensler is fighting all the way out the door, fighting with Wall Street. Just yesterday, days from his exit, Wall Street's biggest lobbying firms sued the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Gensler is chairman, the toughest battler for Wall Street reform and regulation in the Obama administration, the bane of big banks. Now he's going, headed out. He's with us for his exit interview this hour on Point. Street fighter, as in Wall Street, Gary Gensler. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question on what's been done and what has not? What's your confidence in Wall Street oversight now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a minute, we will be joined by Gary Gensler. But first, Jesse Eisinger joins us from New York City, Pulitzer Prize-winning financial reporter for ProPublica. Jesse Eisinger, welcome back to On Point. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
I'm reading a headline in the Wall Street Journal. This is a couple years old now, but I wonder if it still pertains. It says, "Meet Wall Street's arch enemy, Gary Gensler." How did he get that status? Does he still have it?
Well, I agree with your assessment that he was the Obama administration's toughest financial regulator. It's somewhat of a low bar, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I think that Gensler is going to leave being able to hold his head up high. He has accomplished a substantial amount with few resources at a sleepy agency, or a heretofore sleepy agency, that really is a kind of obscure, used to be a kind of obscure place for financial reform. So he's had a good tenure.
Not obscure anymore. Warren Buffett called derivatives, and of course the CFTC has oversight now anyway of derivatives. Warren Buffett called them financial weapons of mass destruction. They're seen as having been key to the meltdown at the beginning of the Great Recession. Describe why those were so damaging then, and what's Gensler done to try and bring them in line?
Yes, well, that's accurate. They were at the heart of the financial crisis, and derivatives are side bets on underlying securities, and such side bets on mortgages were the thing that brought down AIG, brought down Merrill Lynch, brought down Citigroup, among others, Bear Stearns initially. And what they were completely opaque, sometimes tailored individually between financial institutions that regulators couldn't see. Couldn't regulate by law, so they had no idea what the exposure was, and there was enormous amount of embedded leverage in them. In other words, borrowed money, and
so they became the kind of echo chamber that made everything worse, that upped the volume on everything.
Exactly, and so it rippled through the financial crisis, bringing down financial institutions and necessitating the bailout.
So here we are. He comes in at the CFTC. They have a responsibility for that part of the meltdown. Dodd-Frank comes in, and his authority, even with a small agency, his authority expands.
Yes, his authority expands, and he may tell you his budget gets curtailed. So they have to do much, much more with less, which is an extraordinary thing and a terrible thing, really. He's managed to do this. He's managed to put most of these derivatives through something called clearinghouses and onto exchanges. They hasn't happened yet entirely, but they're headed in that direction. And what this means is that there's a central body that stands between most players in the derivatives market and is going to make good on derivatives bets if one party can't. And so that will make the market for most derivatives safer, a lot safer. The problem is that there are some asterisks.
Yeah, asterisks all over, and those are still being fought over as he heads out the door. I mean, there is a storm of activity even now. The Volcker Rule, which Gary Gensler has pushed to make tougher, supposed to go into effect finally next week. A big suit just yesterday brought by the biggest lobbying groups on Wall Street, with him not named, but by inference right there in the suit. Jack Lew, the president's Treasury Secretary, coming out today kind of for a we've done it or we're on our way to cleaning up Wall Street speech. Why is Gary Gensler leaving now? Has it just been long enough? What do you make?
Big mystery. The question is whether he's leaving voluntarily or whether the Obama administration didn't reappoint him because they thought he was tough or difficult to deal with. Bloomberg has reported that he clashed with Jacob Lew, the current Treasury Secretary, over derivatives reform. And so there's a real question here. The Obama administration has a mixed record on financial reform. Of course, they pushed Dodd-Frank, but they undermined key aspects of Dodd-Frank that would have made it stronger. The first Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, was friendly to the banks and not serious about financial reform. And the reform was modest given the size and scope and enormity of the calamity of the financial crisis. We did not change the financial structure of banking in this country. We did not alter the financial architecture of the regulating forces. And so what we have done is done a lot of tinkering around the edges, creating rules for derivatives, creating rules for trading at banks called the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule is going to be stronger than it was going to be 6 months ago. So that's very good. Jacob Lew's own test that he's going to present in a speech today is whether you can, with a straight face, say we have ended too big to fail. And I think the only people who can say that with a straight face are people either without a sense of humor or who have been practicing their straight faces in the mirror for about a year.
We'll ask the man himself, Gary Gensler, on his way out the door.
He's Jesse, a good practitioner of keeping a straight face.
A necessary art up on those tight ropes. Jesse Eisinger with ProPublica, Pulitzer Prize-winning financial reporter there. Always great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's go to the man himself. Joining me now from Washington is Gary Gensler. In his previous life, he spent 18 years at Goldman Sachs, where he became a partner at age 30, which at the time was the youngest to do so in the firm's history. Worked at the Treasury Department under President Clinton and Secretary Robert Rubin in the era of Big D regulation. In 2009, he became chairman of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, on his way out now. President Obama has nominated a successor last month, but still playing an active, even hot role. Gary Gensler, thank you very much for being with us today. Welcome to On Point.
Tom, so good to be with you.
You're a street-fighting man even right now. A big suit brought against your commission just yesterday. Are they going to take down your last push for reform?
I think that reform is so important to the American public to bring transparency and access and competition to this vast market. I feel very good about all that we've done. The guidance that is a subject of this case, I believe that we did appropriately. Congress did not actually even ask us to do such guidance. So it's part of democracy, Tom, that these things sometimes are tested in the courts, but I feel very good about what we did. And at the core of it, it just basically is the lesson of history. AIG, of course, nearly brought down our U.S. economy.
Yep.
And this insurance
company
was—
Yes,
it was nearly brought down our economy with derivatives, and it was operating a French bank in a branch in London, and Congress was very clear in their words that we had to learn that lesson, and if there was a possibility, or as Congress said, if there was a direct and significant connection to the activities here in the U.S., we needed reform.
Boy, late in the day, and they're still coming after you. Judd Gregg is the head of this lobbying outfit now, former U.S. senator, and he's complaining in the suit about policies championed, this is you, I guess, by a single individual in a single agency, by what amounts to individual fiat. We're going to try and dig into a bunch of this, Gary Gensler, but when you stand back, where do we stand now? These years of your work after the crash, You know, Jesse Geisinger says you can't say with a straight face that we're out of too big to fail. Are we halfway through the necessary work of regulation in your view? A quarter? Three quarters? Where are we?
I think we're very far along. At our small agency, we were asked by Congress to do about 60 different rules. And we've done the bulk of those, nearly all of those. We've also issued some guidance.
Under Dodd-Frank, yeah.
Yeah, so financial reform to the American public means that this vast market, it's $380 trillion of derivatives or swaps. That, by the way, is about $22 of swaps and derivatives for every dollar that goes through our economy. We now know every transaction that happens, the price and volume, and the public can see that free of charge. Sort of like in the stock market, you have a ticker tape. Mm-hmm. Now you have the same thing over here in this complex swaps market.
And that did not exist when the economy almost fully crashed.
Right. 8 million people lost their jobs, and at the core of the crisis were these swaps and derivatives. AIG, this large financial institution, but others as well, mm-hmm. were using swaps not only to hedge risk, but also to speculate on the markets, whether housing prices would go up or down and the like. And what we found is the system was so interconnected with these complex derivatives that the U.S. taxpayers put $180 billion into AIG, and too many people lost their jobs.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the Obama administration's toughest fighter for Wall Street reform. Now outgoing, we're doing an exit interview with Gary Gensler, chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, a one-time Wall Street guy turned Wall Street fighter. President Obama talking about the work that he's done earlier, early last month when he was nominating Timothy Massad to succeed Gary Gensler as chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. The president spoke here about the CFTC's accomplishments under current chair, our guest today, Gary Gensler. Here's the president.
They've successfully imposed nearly $1.8 billion in penalties against financial firms that engaged in rate-fixing schemes. They worked to make sure that an irresponsible few can't hurt consumers by illegally manipulating or rigging energy markets for their own gain. And they've done it all while a swarm of special interest lobbyists have done everything possible to thwart their every move.
The president talking there about the work of Gary Gensler. Brooksley Bourne, his predecessor in the role, has given him his stamp of approval. Wall Street, the Wall Street Journal headline says it all, "Meet Wall Street's arch enemy," they wrote. Gary, I've got a lot of questions for you, but really there are listeners who want to speak to you directly, and I want to bring a couple on, many lined up here. Irene in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Irene, you're on the air with Gary Gensler.
Hi. I just want to say thank you. I've read about what you've done for a long time, and I think you must have paid dearly in terms of personal relationships, given how you went against the financial industry in the way that you did. And they had to be your colleagues and friends in the past, and you made a sacrifice, and it's appreciated. And also, I mean, I consider the financial industry a criminal industry by and large. And I think that somebody like you, given what I know about you, would make a phenomenal candidate for president. So if you consider it, this is a big thank you from at least one person who does know about your work.
All right. A nomination right in over the air. Irene, thank you for your call. Gary, how frank can you be about how hard it's been? You were in the heart of this. You were a partner at Goldman Sachs, the youngest ever at the time. I'm sure you made out very well there, but those were your colleagues and your buddies. You helped deregulate that world for them, you might say. And then you turned around with all this tough work, and I mean, it's all over the place in the clips, the sour grapes about that. What about the personal side of it?
Well, first, let me thank Irene. It's remarkable compliment. Since you live in Massachusetts, though, I'm assuming you're not the Irene I dated in high school who lives in New Jersey.
Or your mom.
Yeah, that's very sweet. I think we just have different roles. The role that the president asked me to take on and when you're in public service is to serve the public at large. And the role, even when I was on Wall Street, was about serving customers, but yes, maximizing the revenues of the firm. So it's very different roles. And I think that I have three daughters. I wouldn't put my daughters on the streets at night with the car if I didn't think there were cops on the beat, traffic lights, street lights, and the like. And unfortunately, in 2008, we Americans all were innocent bystanders, so to speak, and 8 million people lost their jobs because the highways of finance were not properly overseen or policed. On a personal note, I just hope that people of finance respect the job we've done. We've had some differences, but they're not personal differences. They're just differences of jobs, and I think our role is to bring some common sense reform to these markets.
I mean, can it really be just differences of jobs? Do you get the hairy eyeball when you're, I don't know where, at the club or the court? Or I mean, I'm reading here, people, Michael Mayo says, this is the new era of big brother banking. Wall Street Journal calling you the polarizing regulator, antagonizing the banks. Can you stay in that circle and crack the whip at the same time?
Well, you know, it's not for the thin-skinned, these jobs. And if you step out into the public square, and any regulator is in the public square, you have to advocate for a point of view and give speeches and go on radio shows like this and to make a point. I think the point is that the public is best served when there's real transparency and you can see the prices. 5 years ago, you couldn't see it. Today, you can see it.
And still with all that, Jesse Geisinger, you heard him at the top, Pulitzer Prize winner there, saying we have at best modest reform overall.
Well, I think that and I'd be glad if Jesse came back on. I think that he was very aware that we now have the vast majority of this market is transparent and the public can see the prices in live streaming ways. The vast majority of this market is in what he called central clearing, and that lowers risk because if the transaction fails, somebody else is going to stand in those shoes and make sure it goes on. AIG, we did not have that transparency. AIG, we did not have that central clearing. So I think that we've moved the ball forward significantly. Is there more to be done? Absolutely. Our small agency doesn't have the right resources. We've definitely been underfunded, and I feel that that's something that we still need to advocate for.
We'll look at that kind of a chokehold there. Gary Gensler is with us. He's on his way out as chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air with Gary Gensler.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Gensler. The great reforms of the 1930s were designed to instill confidence in the financial markets and specifically to allow for capital formation. A lot of people in your audience may not understand derivatives are not stocks, they're not bonds,
yeah.
They aren't actual shares of anything tangible. They are bets on the movement of those underlying things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't actually help directly in capital formation. The last 30 years have seen a tremendous expansion in derivative trading, in the share of the economy that the financial sector absorbs, and in income inequality. The financial sector is now almost three times the size of what it was in about 1980. During the 1950-1960s
okay.
period.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, what's the benefit to the overall society for allowing such expansive derivatives trading? And don't you think it detracts from the capital formation that was the heart of all of those reforms that were put in after the Great Depression?
There is a good and deep question, and I appreciate your calling in with it, Mark. It's not just Mark, Gary. I was exchanging emails earlier today with one of your deep predecessors, Jim Stone, who was chair at the CFTC way back, who said that you would be his pick for best chair ever of the CFTC, but that you are not as skeptical as he might be about the big picture, the basic role and economic value of derivatives. It's the same thing that our caller Mark points to. How do you, well, you know, maybe we need deeper reform, even to consider, you know, why do we have them if they're the, what's Warren call them, financial weapons of mass destruction?
Mark asked an excellent question, and many people have asked me this over these 5 years. Derivatives began around the Civil War in our country when farmers wanted to lock in a price at harvest time. They don't want to deal with, is the corn price or wheat price going to be higher or lower? Let's lock that in.
And they still do.
And they focus on the field. 150 years later, it's the same thing. It took 60 years to bring the first reform to those markets, and President Roosevelt, and after that crisis, brought that reform in the 1930s. In the 1980s, a new product started called swaps, which was not regulated, partly just because it had a different label. It was called swaps, and the product from the 100 years earlier was called futures. My mom, who's 86, often asked me about this. But to Mark's question, the benefit of a swap or a future is that a department store can lock in the currency price when they're importing from China or Europe or something, that the energy company can lock in the fuel price and focus on what they do well and build the economy and grow the economy.
Now,
on the other hand,
from the farmers to the retailer you're describing there, I mean, isn't that still a far cry from the bleeding edge of swaps that Goldman Sachs and other big banks have played?
So, Tom, you're absolutely right. Hedgers and speculators meet in the marketplace, and this has been a debate for 150 years. We want these markets for all of the economic good they do for the hedgers, in whether that's the retailer, the community bank, or the farmer. And then speculators stand on the other side, and how do we ensure that those speculators don't abuse the market, there's not manipulation, as we found in the interest rate markets. At the core of this market, we found that interest rates were being rigged and pervasively rigged by big banks in something called the London Interbank Offer Rate.
LIBOR.
LIBOR. These are the challenges to ensure that when hedgers meet speculators, ultimately for the benefit of the hedgers, that farmer or retailer, ultimately, for that benefit, when they meet, it's free of fraud and abuse and manipulation, and it's transparent. And a lot of light shines on it, which we did not have 5 years ago.
I mean, you say a lot of light, and there's certainly more than 5 years ago, but they're fighting tooth and nail all the way to the very last days of your tenure there. I mean, this suit was brought yesterday. You're pushing for tougher regulations even as you head out the door, and you've got big suits in your face.
Tom, again, it's part of democracy. I think the lessons of 2008 are very clear, and Congress wrote specific words in the statute to remind, to make sure we kept those lessons in place. AIG was overseas. Lehman Brothers, your listeners might remember, had 3,300 legal entities when it failed, many of them overseas, and the risk comes right back crashing to our shores. Their affiliate overseas in Europe had 130,000 of these swaps transactions on. So what we did was, we had Wall Street come to us. We had international banks come to us and ask us for guidance. We were not required in the statute to do this, but we said, all right, we'll try to give some guidance, and we sought public comment on that guidance. But it's not surprising that there's challenges here because there's a lot of money at stake, and for the financial community, transparency and lightness does shift some of their information advantage to the broad public.
And boy, have they howled about the way you've played those negotiations. You know them too well after those years at Goldman in a way. Jim, in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air with Gary Gensler.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Gensler mentioned the figure, I think $300-some trillion of derivatives out there. I've heard figures twice that, $620-some trillion. Number one, I guess my first question is, if it's a secret process, how does he or anybody know what the value is out there? And that's my first question. And obviously, do you need to know that to regulate them? If it's irrelevant, who cares? But don't you need to know that? And if so, how did you find that number out?
Jim, let us pick it up. How much do you know at this point, Gary? I mean, there's a big part that's in this country, but it's global. Part of the big fight you're still having is over how much regulation you'll do after about the trading that goes beyond the U.S. borders. What about Jim's question on full transparency?
Jim, 5 years ago, we didn't know the size of this market. and Congress passed a law that said that dealers and non-dealers alike had to report to data repositories and tell us about their trades. That went live about 14 months ago. And starting 2 weeks ago, we started to publish the aggregate data. It's about $380 trillion. There's 1.8 million transactions in the data repositories, and we're actually adding up these numbers.
Is that a global number, or what is that?
These are all of the swaps that are required to be reported, and so this means this would be with U.S. persons, and it's not necessarily a global number. If there was a transaction, let's say, in China between a Chinese bank and a Chinese corporate.
So Jim could be right. I mean, what about when U.S. banks are doing that business abroad?
That's supposed to be in the data repositories. What I wanted to say to Jim's question is there were surveys done prior to this that do speak to a larger number. Those surveys survey the banks and have something, sorry to be technical, that double counts some of the transactions in the clearinghouses. And we are only counting them once, so there's not this confusion of double counting.
But there still is this fight at the border, right, that the banks say, we don't want your oversight on all of our foreign activity.
There is that, Tom. You're absolutely right. It's critical that we cover the Lehman Brothers of the future, the AIGs of the future. That's what Congress said expressly in the statute. Risk will come right back here. In 1998, I was asked by then Secretary Rubin to go up to a small office in Connecticut of a big hedge fund called Long-Term Capital Management that was failing. Mm-hmm. That hedge fund had over $1 trillion of swaps and derivatives, and I was the one who had to make the phone call to the then secretary and say, excuse me, Mr. Secretary, I'm sorry to tell you, they booked all of their transactions in the Cayman Islands. And he said, well, what does that mean? And I said, I don't really know, but I know we don't have much jurisdiction there, and it's going to hurt our economy. So those lessons are what Congress expressly addressed. If we, for some reason, were not consistent with Congress, then you could basically, excuse the expression, you could drill a hole in the bottom of reform, and everything would just be, so to speak, booked in the Cayman Islands.
I mean, isn't that the sound of drill bits all over the place right now? This big suit brought to you against you by the group that Judd Gregg heads up, aren't they still fighting on exactly that front?
Well, they may be, but that's part of our democracy, and I respect that. I believe that though Congress did not require us to do this guidance, we did it appropriately. We fully complied with the various mandates from Congress.
And, you know, it's not entirely reassuring, forgive me, but you say it's part of our democracy, and I get that. On the other hand, a lot of people are listening and thinking, way too much of our democracy is bought and paid for. Your organization, you know, you're yourself saying you barely have enough staff to do your job. The very people who were trying to regulate so that our personal, individual economic lives don't get crushed have an awful lot of outsized sway in the system, don't they?
Well, we have opened up our agency so that you can see all the people that come in and knock on our door and advocate. But you're right. It's generally the large financial institutions that knock on our door more than the people like Jim and Mark and Irene.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the Obama administration's toughest fighter for Wall Street reform, now outgoing, doing an exit interview, you might say, with Gary Gensler, chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, joins us today from Washington. Kind of grew up on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs, was part of the deregulation crew, came back in the last 5 years, and did as much or more than anybody else to try and push the dial back the other way. Now he's headed out. Gary, lots of callers for you, but let me just ask right off the bat, why are you leaving? I know 5 years is plenty of time, but there's a lot of speculation. You know, open the web and people are saying you're being pushed out.
Oh, nothing could be further from the truth, Tom. I've taken on 5 years of the greatest professional honor in my life, but it's a tough job. The White House has been very generous, starting over a year ago, asking me whether I'd serve another term. These jobs do have terms, actually. There is a time limit.
So you were asked and declined to serve another 5 years?
Yeah, I feel that we largely did what we set out to do, what Tim Geithner, who is Secretary of Treasury, and Mary Shapiro at the SEC, and the president, and Larry Summers and others set out to do. We laid some of this out on yellow pads during the presidential transition 5 years ago this month.
You're talking the Obama presidential transition. Was a lot of that undoing what you'd already done in the Clinton years?
Look, we took a clean look at everything. We had the worst financial crisis in 80 years, and I think that the markets had evolved and it changed, but also I think looking back on some of the things that we had done or not done in earlier times, we said we have to do that differently. And it was Secretary Geithner's and President Obama's leadership and working with Barney Frank in the House and Chris Dodd in the Senate and many, many other wonderful members, Colin Peterson in the House and Blanche Lincoln in the Senate and so forth. I think we came to a very positive result, which this financial reform was called Dodd-Frank, and we've largely put that in place. We have transparency in this market we didn't have 5 years ago. We've lowered the risk. We've brought the biggest cases in this interest rate rigging called LIBOR, and we've exposed that. So I feel very proud and honored to have served, but and this administration has been terrific to the agency and to reform and to me.
But off you go. Charlie in Scituate, Massachusetts, you're on with Gary Gensler.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gary. I'm not an economist. In fact, I nearly flunked out of college because of my economics grades.
Okay. Charlie, if I can interrupt, I got a D in high school French, so.
Everybody's got something.
But I'm curious because I became interested in the situation from an On Point program about 10, 12, 15 years ago. I can't remember how long ago it was, Tom.
Oh, Lord. The years do stretch.
Okay. It was discussing a woman whom I came to greatly admire, although I didn't know her. Her name was Brooksley Bourne.
Mm-hmm.
And Brooksley Bourne was the head of the CFTC, as far as I know.
Yes.
And that she worked against Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers, Robert Rubin, Tom, Theodore Geithner, and Bill Clinton himself, who all thought that getting rid of Glass-Steagall and was a good idea, and she fought against it and predicted the downfall. Nobody ever gave her credit except for the JFK Medal of Honor, the Presidential Medal, whatever it's called, the Freedom Medal, is it?
Yeah.
And she got that because she came up and stood up against what was the policy. Now you're saying that all of these men wanted to have you carry out what you've done in 5 years, and now you're retiring. She was kicked out, as far as I could judge, and I'm not a professional on the inside workings of government.
Hey, Charlie, let us pick up the Brooksley Bourne story, because, yes, of course, she was, the outspoken opponent of the deregulatory era, up against all those you name, and maybe up against Gary Gensler. She's spoken favorably of you since then, Gary, but what about looking back on Brooksley Bourne's warnings in those years? Was she right?
Oh, I think Brooksley is a terrific public servant. I've turned to Brooksley these last 5 years on a number of occasions to seek her advice. And I think looking back, I was part of the Clinton administration too, serving as an assistant secretary and then later in a more senior role, an undersecretary. Looking back, I think that there are things that we should have done more to protect the American public. Brooksley's a terrific public servant.
Here's a listener who goes by the handle Government Banking Surf. Commenting just on this and to that point says, bring back the essence of Glass-Steagall. Let Wall Street and investors do what they want with their play money, but outlaw bailouts. Says Wall Street gamblers should be free to cannibalize themselves, but they shouldn't be subsidized by the government and Federal Reserve, and they shouldn't be able to gamble with our savings. And this, there's no top-down micromanagement solution to this. Rebuild the Glass-Steagall wall. What do you say to that, Gary?
Well, at the core, I think our free market system works, that firms have a freedom to fail. My dad never went to college, had a small business, but if he didn't make payroll on a Friday, he'd be shut down by Monday, and Baltimore City and the state of Maryland wouldn't have bailed him out.
And as you say that, everyone's thinking exactly that. Bailout. We saw it.
Yeah, and I think that's at the core. We shouldn't have that. And this financial reform has, I believe, really lowered the risk of that. Our derivatives and swaps reform is doing that. But also, I'd note 2 weeks ago, one of the largest rating agencies in America, Moody's, actually publicly said that they, Moody's, would no longer be giving the largest five or six banks what they called an uplift, and a higher credit rating because of some perceived backing of the government. That was a big thing that this large rating agency said, you know, this financial reform looks like it's working, looks like it's lowering the risk that any government would stand in. And that's to the credit of the Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and others.
I mean, fair enough, but Moody's didn't exactly cover itself in glory back in the day. There's a lot of skepticism about that. In this day, we get these back and forths going. Same listener says, come on. He says, can we make cocaine less dangerous? We can ban it, legalize it, whatever. At the end of the day, regular people should just avoid it. He says, wasting our time and money thinking we can make all this less dangerous is futile. Now, maybe you've made it less dangerous, but maybe the danger's still sitting there ticking.
Well, Tom, I will agree. There's risk cannot be repealed. Part of our remarkable success as a nation is that people innovate, take risk, and even speculate. Hedgers meet speculators in markets. Somebody thinks a stock will go up. Somebody else sells it because they think it might go down. I think our role is to make sure there's bright lights, just like there are bright lights on a street, that there's cops on the beat to ensure against manipulation and fraud and abuse.
But there's always
degrees. The large firms can't be depending upon the government to bail them out.
We did pretty well with Glass-Steagall for a long time.
Yes, we did as a nation. But as the crisis shows, there's a lot that's changed. There were no swaps and derivatives in the 1930s. There were futures, and President Roosevelt said, let's regulate futures. Now we've also brought that transparency and reform to this sister and bigger market called swaps. So we always have to evolve.
Nancy in Madison, Wisconsin, what do you think about our evolution, Nancy?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering where the evolution is and what's to stop Wall Street from turning into a dangerous get-rich-quick scheme again in the housing market where the taxpayers have to bail it out. We hear about this celebrated housing recovery, yet the very companies, banks, that foreclosed on more than 10 million people in the United States are buying up these homes, and they're turning them into rental properties. They're securitizing these and selling bonds in the Blackstone Group, which is owned by, it's a who's who of the banking crisis problem, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, UBS, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs. As of last month, they've spent $7.5 billion to buy up more than 40,000 foreclosed homes across the country. 1,400 homes in Atlanta, reportedly, in a single day.
Nancy, maybe that's a good business. People have to live somewhere. Now they're renting those back. It may not, I don't know if it'll end up being good for common citizen, but it might be a good business for the banks or no?
But now we're counting on these guys being landlords and of them actually repairing these properties. And so they're selling these, they have what's reported by real estate agents as a severely optimistic 95% rental rate at $1,300 a month. You're talking about inner city Detroit, Atlanta, Los Angeles, and they're securitizing these and selling them again, to investors. What is to stop this from happening all over again?
Gary Gensler?
Nancy, I think one of the core pieces of reform was to actually stand up a new agency. And I know that one new agency isn't going to be the secret to success, but the Consumer Financial Consumer Financial Products Board, which was an innovation that the president fully embraced. Senator Elizabeth Warren had been behind. Richard Cordray is running it now. Really is bringing new reforms to the mortgage market.
But is that relevant to her question about Blackstone and other big groups buying up gazillions of properties all across the country?
I think it is. I'm not an expert, Tom, to all the details, but I do think it is because they are now really separate from the other regulators. They've got one core mission, and that's about people who borrow to finance their home or to take out consumer credit or other types of consumer finance, and to ensure that the disclosures, the protections, that we really stamp out some of the abuses that were in the housing markets in the past. But we've got to be vigilant because ultimately finance has to work for the American public and serve not only the hedgers in the swaps market, but the tens of millions of people that take out a mortgage or consumer borrowing, or the small businessman like my dad.
But
that's
the
where
rub.
It's got to work for.
Sure, but that's the rub, because that's exactly where confidence was most deeply hurt, that it ultimately works for the regular citizen in this country. One more right here. David in Mansfield, Connecticut. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I want to raise the issue of the power of Wall Street. I don't think Americans have understanding of the amount of money that this segment of the economy can bring to bear on the government. I believe that the whole Congress is pretty much in the hands of Wall Street because they need money so much when they're running for re-election. Mm. And look at the president's appointees. All the people have been mentioned, Rubin, Geithner, and all those guys come right off Wall Street. These have been deregulators from the word go. So we have the chickens who run the coop here, and I totally disagree that tinkering around the edges is going to have any way of diminishing this real corruption of our democracy.
David, thank you for your call. Gary, speak to that. There it is. There's the deep fear that, look, you've done a lot of work and you fought very hard for the progress that you've made, but if you've got the citizenry thinking it's still somehow fundamentally deeply rigged against their common interest, what do we do with that? And is David right? Is it?
Well, I think, David, we've got to keep always explaining broadly to the public what we're doing, what we're advocating for, explaining that, if I, with all respect, can tell you that Tim Geithner served 20 to 30 years in government and never worked on Wall Street. I say that not only because he's a dear friend, but also I just want to address
very
that.
Close at the New York Fed, but okay.
No, the New York Fed is part of the oversight and regulation of the markets. And many people throughout our history, from the days of Thomas Jefferson and so forth, were citizens first, served for a while in government, and went back to being citizens. In those days, it was farmers. I look at all the people that served that you just mentioned, Bob Rubin and others, as excellent public servants that did their best.
Isn't going back to the farm different from going back to Wall Street? So many have, and that raises a lot of questions. Come from there, go back to there, and represent the common guy, the little guy in the middle?
Well, I think it's a great honor to serve. I think that so many people that have served do it with distinction. So I think it's part the vast majority of the people at our career. At our small agency, there's only the five commissioners and maybe five or six other people that are, as we would say in Washington, political appointees. And 650 or so are dedicated a career. But I think in every case, people are serving the public.
And Timothy Geithner, of course, headed off early next year to become president of Warburg Pincus, Wall Street private equity firm. The common question being asked is, why didn't anyone go to jail? What do you say to that, Gary?
Well, we're a civil law enforcement agency, so we work with the Justice Department, who can do just what you just said, send somebody to jail. But we brought cases that were very vigorous and tough to bring, because we found that at the heart of the markets in 2008, interest rates were being pervasively rigged through something called the London Interbank Offer Rate mm-hmm. and a sister rate over in Europe called Euribor. And we have not flinched from bringing cases against big banks or even exchanges during this 5 years, and using that authority that Congress vests in a small agency.
What are your plans post the Commodity Futures Trading Commission?
You know, Tom, I don't know yet. I've been so honored. This is a remarkable journey these last 5 years. I've still got a daughter at home. She's got a couple years in high school, so certainly I'll stay in the Washington community and see what's next.
We'll be watching closely. Listen, for everything that you have done as that stand-up fighter, we're grateful and we thank you, and good luck to you, Gary. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom, and thank all your listeners.
Gary Gensler, outgoing chair of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Coming up tomorrow in this hour, Biden in Beijing, public pensions under the gun, a train off the rails. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Emily Alfin Johnson, Abigail Collins, and Austin Federa. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Thank you.